Hello one and all, and welcome to Handcut Radio. As we get stuck into season two, I'm joined this week by a journalist for whom I have a great deal of respect, Paul Proughton, editor-in-chief of Rob Report US. Paul's career is fascinating. From working on Arena, the first men's style magazine in the UK, to broadcasting and working in creative agencies, he's done the lot. Today, he's been helming this bastion of American luxury for just over 12 months with the clear brief to contemporise Rob Report for today's intelligent luxury consumer. We talk about the state of the publishing industry, how his passion for music has informed his sense of style, and the challenges involved in magazine making today. Here's what he had to say. Well, Mr. Proughton, thank you for being on the pod.
It's a great pleasure.
I feel like we're starting to throw punches in the publishing world now you're on. This is great.
Oh, I don't know about that, but let's see.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I guess there's a lot to talk about. I've been really looking forward to this. It's always a pleasure to chat to you. Busy man that you are.
Likewise.
And I do seem to say this every week, but it seems to work. The best place to start is at the beginning. We're obviously going to talk about Rob Report and about your interest in men's style, but I'm curious to know how you come to be a journalist. You know, where does the interest in journalism come from? Did you fall into it? Was it always a passion?
So when people ask me this, I can remember wanting to be a journalist when I was about 14. But before that, I can't really remember what the catalyst was. I've always loved reading. I've liked to write. That kind of stuff has always been there. But I can remember before that, I thought I wanted to be in advertising because I'd heard something about advertising, and if you're 14, it sounded terribly cool. But that had gone by the time I was about 14 and 15. And I remember going to the Times on work experience when I was about 15. Somehow, you couldn't do it now, I'm sure, but I had 4 weeks at the Times, and I had a week at different sections. And one was business, one was the Abits, one was sport, I think, possibly, and one was books. And by the end of that four-week period, I discovered two or three things. One, that all journalists seem to wear terrible shirts with great bellies poking out between the buttons. And in a drawer next to them, they would have a half-finished manuscript of their book and a half-drunk bottle of whiskey. Now, I'm sure the Times is not like that now, but that's what it kind of appeared to be. And I came out with a very real feeling that I did not want to be a newspaper journalist. I wanted to be in magazines. And I think that's... Before then, I'd read the Beano and Shoot, I think the football one was all those kind of things. I was into magazines. But that was when I really felt I'm going to be a magazine journalist.
Cool. It's so funny that you say that and start with that, because something that I did early on is I ended up spending a month working on The People, when The People was a thing.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it was when I was doing maybe it was AS level, that summer between AS level and A level, and it was the most crushing experience.
Yeah.
I spent the whole month researching fact boxes relating to various different traumas.
Yeah.
And it would literally be, we've got an angle to cover this drug abuse case. So, Alex, go away and find me 10 facts about drug abuse.
Yes, it's quite dark sometimes, those places.
Yeah. Okay, you came away knowing it was going to be magazines.
Yes, and sometimes coming away with a negative is as good as coming away with a positive. If I think it's incredibly hard with young people today trying to work out what they want to do. And actually, if you wake up one day and say, I definitely don't want to be X, that's almost as useful as being, I want to be Y, because there's a million more jobs available now than when granddad that I am, not literally, was a kid. You know, sort of when you're making those choices 25 years ago, there were not the depth of jobs available. So I do feel for youth.
Mm. But you did come away knowing that it was going to be magazines and not newspapers.
Indeed. Yes, I think magazines had always been exciting to me and always been... a kind of source of entertainment and knowledge and just kind of exotic things when you're slightly younger. I can remember reading a magazine called Sky, which is no longer with us, but it was kind of a junior Face.
Mm.
And then obviously The Face and magazines like Arena and Star Mags and those kind of things.
And of course, you worked on Arena.
I did
on
work
your
on
career,
Arena,
didn't you?
Yeah.
And I think I'm right in saying you also launched Heat.
Yes, I was solely responsible for launching Heat. No, so I did English and American Literature at university, and then I did a postgraduate diploma in magazine, in periodical journalism at City. And it was there that someone put, and this really ages me, someone put a fax on the wall, and it was from EMAP, and they were saying they wanted a couple of gophers to go and work on the launch of a new magazine. And I remember interviewing with Mark Frith, who's now the editorial director of Radio Times, I think. And I remember he told me later that I got the job because the last question, it's a Monday morning 10 a.m. interview, the last question was, who's at number one? And I remembered that it was Jamiroquai with that awful Godzilla track, Deeper Underground or whatever it was. I'm not a fan of Jamiroquai, but he got me a job. So I was a gopher. I was, you know, more or less doing the fat boxes and filing all the papers and doing all that kind of stuff. But I got to write a huge amount in the 2 years I was there, and I got to learn from brilliant, brilliant editors, Mark Ellen and David Hepworth and Paul DeNoyer, and there were so many sort of proper bastions of magazine. And Mark Frith, of magazine craft there, that you just absorbed it all for a couple of years, and by the end of it I was kind of a staff writer and just writing about all sorts. But I found myself, because Heat pivoted, originally it was a magazine that was going to take on Entertainment Weekly, so it was all about, it was, as David Hepworth said, it was people who hang up their speakers before they hang up their curtains, which was me and everybody I knew at that time. So it was all about films and music and culture and going out and having fun. And then it slightly pivoted because it realised the audience was mostly female, and that was where the strength was, and Big Brother had happened and the Spice Girls and all this. And I found myself writing about Martin McCutcheon's makeup a bit too often and thought, this probably isn't where I want to go. And then ended up at Arena, which had just been bought by EMAP, and Mark Ellen had just gone to edit it. And that was, I was there for about 7 years, and that was possibly the greatest years of my career. It was just so much fun.
What made it so special?
First of all, I was working with great mates. You know, you work on a magazine and you become very good friends with the people you work with, because you do every, you know, we would go out every night to gigs or to clubs or to events or whatever, and then you it just, your whole life slightly is taken over when you're in your 20s. And I was very fortunate that a lot of what Arena covered was stuff that I was fascinated by and interested in, so it I was kind of writing for me and my mates. So that, I think if you can hit that sweet spot as a journalist, every idea is a good idea, because it's, you know, you are the audience in a sense. So that was, I was very fortunate, and we had brilliant people, and you know, we just could, we were allowed to do daft things. You could have some fun. That was kind of the end of the days when you could have fun on magazines.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, actually, because obviously I hear and have heard over the last few years, while I've been in this industry, many sort of mythic tales of the glory days of magazine making. What was it like, you know, sort of in those early jobs, early on in your career? Was it a very different environment to the kind of magazine environment we experience today?
Yes, I think it was. I was at the tail end, as I say, of the glory days, so I missed the days of brown paper bags arriving off couriers and the afternoon stopping for some fun and games and all that kind of thing. But you know, you'd have a drinks fridge in the office, and you know, you would have fun whenever you wanted. You know, it was kind of the environment. If you create a fun and creative environment, you're going to get fun and creative ideas out of it, ideally. And that kind of really, that, you know, we were fortunate enough that happened. And you still work really, really hard. You still kind of really put the hours in and grafted, but you were just really incredibly passionate about the project. And I think that's the important thing. If you're working with people who live and breathe and would die for the brand, the magazine, because you believe in it so much, then you've got a bit of a team. And
a bit of a segue then, because that's very interesting to me, given my own experience. Were you aware at that time of kind of commercial pressures within magazine making, or not so much?
Yeah, a bit. I joined as associate editor, and by the time I left, I was acting editor. So in those 7 years of various jobs, you know, you're aware that there's a commercial department, and you know, you're not blind to it. But the relationship was pretty good, because the brands that we liked and wanted to write about liked us as well, so it was a kind of a fairly symbiotic partnership.
Worked well.
Wasn't a case of, you know, there was nobody saying you've got to cover this, which I think is probably not always the case now.
Mm. Interesting. I'm interested to kind of follow your trajectory a little bit. Let's rattle on through.
Mm-hmm.
You did, I believe, end up working in newspapers for
a
time.
Yes, I was there. I worked at the Sunday Times for another 7 years, actually. So I had a big chunk of my career at the Sunday Times. I left Arena to go and be on the travel desk at the Sunday Times. And that was a great job. I mean, you say you're a travel writer for the Sunday Times, everyone assumes that you're off kind of 11 months of the year. I think probably we were travelling 2 months of the year, which is still fabulous, but most of the time you're sending other people and you know, marking their homework when they get back. But it was fantastic. And I think travel writing is something that a lot of people get wrong because they immediately feel that they've got to write almost with their elbows, and this isn't going to be helpful on a podcast, but it's kind of like the sun beats down and glorious waves are crashing upon the ocean.
I see.
And people suddenly don't write as they normally write or as they speak or whatever. So that was quite fun to kind of understand that voice and try and get people to write in the right way. But I was very fortunate. I was put on something called the Emerging Leaders Programme while I was there, which was a kind of mini MBA, I guess. It was a fantastic 9-month course with 3 residential bits for people from throughout the News International organisation. And that really changed me as a journalist, because that was the first time that we were encouraged to think beyond the pages of the section you were doing or the magazine I was doing. When I was at Arena, I wasn't thinking at all about EMAP and the bigger business, EMAP being now Bauer. But that was the first time I started kind of moving toward that and thinking about how the business can improve and what was needed and the role of digital and that kind of thing. And at the time, I thought that the Times and the Sunday Times digital platforms were pretty appalling. And part of this ELP program was having kind of the exec members of the News International with you for dinner or whatever, and you know, you drink probably too much red wine and start jabbing your finger at the director of digital for the News International and saying, "Your product's shit." And then I kind of got my comeuppance a few weeks or months later when I was hauled into the editor's office and said, "You're going to edit a digital, an iPad version of the Jubilee. You know, whatever we do for the Jubilee, you're going to run it. It's going to go on the iPad."
Oh, right.
And so that was my kind of introduction to the world of digital, because Arena, we had a kind of very cursory blog thing, but it was a bit rubbish. And that was amazing. Suddenly to be given the responsibility of creating something like that for a brand like that was fantastic. You know, we, for this Jubilee thing, we did all sorts of daft things. Like, there was a thing about dressing the Queen. So we had a silhouette of the Queen with the Queen's head on. Sorry, Mom. And you could swipe and put a barber jacket or a leather jacket on her, and you could change her shoes, and you could do all this kind of nonsense. And then when you finished your styling of the Queen, you pressed a button, and we'd recorded an impressionist to do these impressions of the Queen. So she would say, "One is well wicked," or, you know, all these kind of daft phrases. And for the Sunday Times, that was a bit weird.
That's quite out there.
You know, it was... But, I mean, it was within about 60 pages, and lots of it was all about the kind of wonderful reign that she has and the procession that was going to be. But, you know, if you put these moments of levity within something a bit more formal, then it changes how people perceive it.
Obviously, now you are very... Of course, you are the editor-in-chief of a big lifestyle title, and you have to write across various different sort of elements of luxury. But where did the real passion for menswear come in to your career? Was it always sort of latently there, or...?
Yeah, I think it was. I had a funny kind of flashback the other day that I think style had always been quite important. It was never really fashion. You know, I've never been kind of, I've got to wear the latest X, Y, Z particularly. Although I loved trainers back in the day, and I used to collect them, and I had kind of 60 or 70 pairs of trainers at one point. But kind of music and style have always been kind of fairly easy bedfellows. So depending on what I was listening to at the time, that would kind of almost dictate how I dressed. But there was a period when I had very long hair and I could put my fringe under my chin. I used to sort of worship The Cure and kind of rock and all that kind of stuff. So I dressed like a kind of like Robert Smith from The Cure, with long shirts and
love it.
Terrible clothes. Never quite got to the point where I was putting the makeup on, but certainly back comb the hair and that enormous great beehive thing that used to go and, you know, have terrible parties.
I presume you've sort of you've locked the photos away. Those,
yes, absolutely. I mean, I've been very fortunate in the time in my career because at various, because the internet didn't get to a point where you could, like Facebook wasn't around then. And in a weird part of my career at Arena, I was an MTV presenter for one day a week and was starred in horrendous things. And that period wasn't on, isn't on YouTube. So no one can actually find all these terrible moments. That I've got photos, but you're not seeing them. But anyway, so I think style was kind of important. And I had incredibly ripped jeans, which I got my mum to sew over the knee, under the ribs on the knee.
Patches in.
Jimi Hendrix, who I was obsessed with at the time. And poor mum had to keep sewing all these different things. And I kept ripping these jeans, and cowboy boots, and, you know, proper style horrors. But I'm sure we've all got things like that.
I think my brief flirtation with cowboy boots actually came up in season one.
Yes.
So, I dig that. So you went through a sort of a rock and roll, Jimi Hendrix inspired phase.
Yes, but weirdly all the way through that, I've been really into house music and hip hop, and that really kind of happened, I suppose, towards the end of the Cure phase, we could say, at sixth form or fifth form as it was then. I've loved kind of house music and but that never really influenced too much. You know, I wasn't going around in these baggy, ravey whatnots. But Northern Soul has also been in there, and I would instinctively do the button up of a polo shirt and wear that with the blazer these days. And so the mod kind of thing, as I think it has for a lot of people of my vintage, has been quite an impactful thing. Even if you don't go full mod, you just like the way they care about how they look.
And, and it's neat and trim. And
exactly, and it's all, everything's a little bit kind of, it's attention to detail and that. I think guys like, guys are into style, I think they like the stories behind certain things. They like to know how this works. So if you've got some kind of jacket on that's windproof and waterproof, it's not really enough just to know that. You want to know how the fibres are doing, whatever they're doing, and, you know, where these come from and who was the guy behind the idea and what. You kind of nerd out a bit. I think guys have got a real gene in their DNA for nerdism. And you know, you just got anyone that's got a half interest in clothes, you ask them where their shoes are from, and you know,
yeah, and you get an essay.
Right, yeah. It's like, all right. So I think I find that fascinating. I've always been fascinated with men, with the kind of the inside of men's heads and how to talk to them and how to communicate in a way that that works, that isn't patronising, that's entertaining, that has authority, but at the same time is you know, not banging someone ahead with fact and knowledge. I think that's something that I've thought about all the way through my career, and something I hope Robert Port does now, and I hope Arena certainly did back in the 2000s.
Let's begin on the Rob Report chapter then.
Sure.
You have been editor-in-chief of the US edition of The Mothership for a year now.
Yep.
How did that come to be?
Well, after the Sunday Times, I did what you're now doing and was kind of freelance and did all sorts of daft jobs, and you're doing it far more successfully than I ever did. But
well.
But I started working for a creative agency called Brave New World, which, although I didn't know it to begin with, the editorial director of that is a brilliant woman, Jill Morgan, and she had been told by a few people, you should speak to this guy who's just left the Sunday Times, and a lot of people were telling me, you should speak to this wonderful woman called Jill Morgan. So eventually we kind of met up and chatted, and Jill and her business partner James Collard ran the editorial side of Brave New World, and they're both brilliant editors and wonderful people, and I think if you've got that combination, you're going to produce a nice little workshop of creative people. So they had lots of very nice kind of luxury travel magazines and brands and this kind of thing, so there was various things that I could help them with. They didn't have a huge grasp on digital, and that was something that I just sort of come from. So I helped them launch something for Valentino, which was digitally focused, and it was a website. Digitally focused, it was an actual website. and then there was various other projects we worked on, and we were looking for something for me to come on board properly as staff. And that's when the Rob Report UK conversation started happening. So they won that piece of business, and I came on as editor of that, and with James Collard as editor-in-chief. So I helped them launch that magazine, which was a great honour, because actually launching anything is pretty fine. It's horrendous, and you've got to work incredibly hard and, you know, up against deadlines, but it's the energy involved in that is brilliant.
Yeah.
But we had a ridiculous opportunity to completely reimagine a brand, because no one had heard of Rob Report over here. And Rob Report in America was actually quite stuffy and a bit out of date and not really loved, certainly from a design point of view, and was just not contemporary in any way. So we were able to say, because we had some kind of crazy joint venture deal rather than the normal licensing deal that you would normally get if you were going to do, you know, Esquire in wherever, we were able to say, well, we're going to completely redesign the magazine and we're going to do all our own content. We don't want any of yours. And the company said, great, fine. So we basically built a magazine.
Yeah.
Built a contemporary luxury magazine for men from the ground up, and were able to kind of run with it for a while. So it was brilliant.
I remember the first few issues coming out and me going, oh, this is really interesting, because I'd at that time been at the Rake for about 3 years and I was starting to think about where I might want to go next. And I remember how we met, which is that I ended up having a sneaky coffee with you and Mr. Collard, and then ended up writing a few sneaky bits of the magazine under a pen name.
Exactly.
And if anyone from the Rake hears this, they'll be very cross.
You'll be fired.
Nothing they can do.
No, exactly. Yeah, so it was kind of, we were in a little place near here in Soho, and they had a little townhouse, the kind of 3-4 floors of that. And the editorial team was in a kind of tiny little bunker. But it was just, again, it was just great fun. I think magazines should be fun, certainly in the lifestyle style world. You know, there's lots of very serious magazines, but if you're in that kind of environment, that should be fascinating and fun and energising to produce. And it was all of those things. It probably wasn't read by many people, because it was very hard to get the word out, and, you know, unless you have an enormous budget for PR and all the rest of it, and you're on the Today Show every 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to launch things these days.
And I guess also getting any reach on digital with a brand new website and absolutely. Just resourcing it. I mean, that was always the most difficult thing at the Jackal in that first 2 years, was just getting eyeballs on digital, producing enough content, resourcing social. It's that bit is hell.
Yeah, so we all did social, and we all did, you know, we had one item a day on our website. And we could take American content, but I don't remember taking very much. But it was trying to build all this up, and it was James and myself and a guy, Alex, who's our kind of staff writer, and a couple of other people within the group, and Jill was kind of the editorial director. And it was very much kind of DIY, you know. It was the worst thing you could say in these things, like a startup. I just want to punch people that say that continuously, but it kind of was, you know, we were just building a magazine. So anyway, to answer your question finally, after about a year and a half of doing that, PMC bought Rob Report in America, and Jay Penske, his name is on the door, he's the Penske Media Corporation, he flew over to meet with all of us, and we were kind of like, what's going on? Surely if he was going to fire us, he'd just send a lawyer and a stern look, and he wouldn't waste his own time coming here. But he did, and he kind of met with all of us for 2 hours or so. What really impressed me was he'd really done his homework. He knew that I'd been at Arena. He said he loved Arena and had read it before. He knew about my digital work at the Times, and he knew about James's career. So, you know, he'd done his homework, and I quite liked him. And it turned out we weren't able to do a deal, so Brave New World stopped doing Rob Report in the UK. But fast forward a year or so, and I get an email saying, we have a leadership opportunity at one of our titles. Would you be interested in relocating to either New York or LA? And I remember sort of calling my wife, because we just decided we were going to move out of London and we were going to move back to the Shires and get a house and do all that kind of stuff. And I said, someone's just asking us to move to wherever, and we're not going to do that. We've got a plan. And my wife God love her, if you'll excuse the language, said, fuck the plan, let's move to New York. So that's where we went.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time to introduce Handcut Radio's very first sponsor. My relationship with Florist London is a long and happy one. I've shopped at this Royal Warrant Holding perfumer for years because it ticks a lot of my boxes. Florist was founded on Jermyn Street in 1730 and is still family-owned today. In fact, it has been for 8 generations now. Moreover, the company develops all its fragrances in-house, thanks in no small part to the efforts of perfumery director Edward Bodenham and his perfumer Nicola Pozzani, and creates all its scents in England too. Now, Florist is releasing Vert Fougère, Nicola's magnum opus and his first official release into the Florist private collection. I've tried it and it's lovely. Woody, with a touch of smoke and green notes, it's well-rounded and it's elegant. Excitingly, we're able to offer Handcut Radio listeners the chance to sample Vert Fougère ahead of the pack too. We have 100 sample files to give away at random to 100 listeners. Visit handcutradio.com/florists and input your postage details for the chance to receive a sample. If you're one of the lucky ones, Florists will ship you a sample forthwith. Vert Fougère is a really lovely scent and a big moment for Florists, so don't miss the chance to try it for yourself. We'll be bringing you some more insight into just what makes Florists a firm favourite of mine next week, but for now, on with the podcast.
So you find yourself as the editor-in-chief of this really sort of, I don't know how to describe Rob Report, this sort of really hefty American title. It is a sort of a...
Yeah, in America it's very well known and very well respected. And it's basically the leading voice in luxury lifestyles. That is our cachet now. Because there isn't really another publication that covers everything that Rob Report does. There are lots of great magazines that do a bit of style and a little bit of the cursory lifestyle, or they're big on cars and they'll do a bit of lifestyle there, but in terms of covering the widest gamut of things that a successful man might be interested in, so whether that's style, jewellery, watches, travel, art, design, food and drink, to the kind of stuff that they might buy, so that's cars in America, cars, boats and planes are big, whereas in the UK we kind of didn't really cover that. Bikes, watches, massive, obviously.
Yeah.
And I'm probably missing categories, but cigars, spirits, wine, you know, the whole shebang. So we try our best to cover all of those with authority and with a newly engaging voice. I think that was one of the biggest things we tried to do.
And that was a part of your core brief when you joined. Because what interests me about this chapter is you're dropped into this big sort of heritage media brand in America.
Yeah.
With a young family, you're in a different country. I mean, I would be utterly terrified.
It was, yes, it's one of the things you do and you kind of think, oh, that was brave. Whereas at the time you're just like, wow, this is exciting, let's do it. And it was really hard. It still is really hard, to be honest. But certainly those first few months, we had a corporate apartment in Midtown near where the office is. And we're 2 blocks from the Empire State Building. So you come out of the door and it's just full of tourists taking photos, sometimes of you. And you're just like, why? What's going on? I've got a pram and my wife's here and please go away. So that was, and it was the tail end of the summer and it was incredibly hot and humid and it was raining and then sunny and it was kind of bonkers. And you walk into a room where it's odd because Rob Report previously was based in LA. So I was in New York and there was the commercial team mostly there and about 3 editorial people. But my entire, other than that, editorial team was in LA. So my first day I had this huge kind of TV conference with sort of 30 people on TV and then sort of 20 people in this room all firing questions at me, sort of like, what watches do you like? And, you know.
Yeah, and you've got no answers yet.
Almost interrogating you, like, why have you got the job? But it was, yeah, you know, it's been fine. There's been some great people along the way that have helped. And, you know, we redesigned the magazine pretty quickly because that, for me, was, we needed to kind of use that as a benchmark and to go out to the industry and say, this is what we now stand for. So we redesigned the mag in about within the first 3 months or so. And then the digital piece is harder because it's just enormous. It's much bigger. And the brief is to grow that, obviously, and to, that's where revenue comes from a lot of the time with brands like this. But we're very fortunate because our print revenue actually is still very strong. The last issue that I did before I came here was the best of the best, and it's something like 358 pages. Or something. It's enormous.
Yeah,
it's kind of like old school Vogue September issue kind of thing. So we do still have a robust print business, but it is, you know, it's not shooting up at great lengths. It's pretty static. So in order to find growth areas, I think magazines now, brands, you have to think like a brand. You know, I'm not the editor of a magazine. I feel like I'm the editor of a brand far more.
Yeah.
And that includes now events, and it includes potentially e-commerce and all other areas of things. You've got to be useful to your audience far more often than just once a month. And you've got to be able to provide something that they need, often without them really knowing that they need it. And you've got to do that daily, ideally with social, hourly or, you know, whatever. So it's a much, much bigger beast being sitting in my chair on magazines of brands now than it was 20 odd years ago.
It's very interesting to me to hear you talk about a media brand, because again, something that I learned, I guess relatively recently, probably only in the last year of being at the Jackal, was getting into this mentality of, we are a young media brand, stop thinking about a magazine. Yeah. That in itself is a huge... Well, I mean, that's kind of hellish. I mean, we've all got to do it. The industry has to do this to survive and to continue to grow. But what are some of the challenges involved in, you know, what's been great and what's been hellish about the last year?
I think I've been very fortunate in that I've come into a brand that has a really committed core readership. So we have a readership of 100,000 plus. But within that, we genuinely do. So Rob Report is a luxury lifestyle magazine, and we are talking to very, very successful people. So I think there's a sense that you can kind of... Lots of journalists, when they talk to advertisers or they talk to PRs, there's a tendency to kind of talk up your audience. And other than the Sunday Times, where you do have that large segment of newspaper-reading people at the weekend, this is really the first time I've been able to say, well, actually... My audience is who I say that it is. We are very fortunate to have lots of, and I struggle with this because being British, it's not about the money. It's not, we have millionaires and billionaires who read the magazine and are very responsive to it. But I always talk in terms of success rather than in terms of money because I'm British and I find it terribly difficult. So we do Car of the Year, for example, is one of our huge events, our leading event of the year, where we have 250 readers judge these cars. So over the course of about 3 weeks in 2 day segments, we have readers who pay to come and drive 11, 12 of the best supercars of that year.
Awesome.
It's quite fun. And then they judge it. It's very carefully done. There's lots and lots of questions. It's very kind of rigorously adjudicated, if you like. And then there's a dinner where they get to take the mic and talk about what they liked and didn't like and which one they might buy and all the rest of it. But these kind of people at the end of this event will have bought some of these cars. You know, we don't get anything from it, but these. You know, about 14 or 15 cars up to about 2025, they will buy the cars because they can and because they're passionate about this kind of stuff. So we have an audience that if we say this is good, they would kind of believe us and check it out themselves. So I think that's a real privilege, and you've got to, you know, respect that.
Yeah. Now, that is fascinating, and there are a few kind of different strands I'd like to pull out on that note. The first is... I wondered whether we could sort of cast our minds back a little bit and whether you had any thoughts on the conversation that launched Handcut Radio that I had with Simon Crompton, who I know is also a contributor. obviously Simon and I sort of threw some ideas around that I was slightly nervous about putting out there at the time about the relationship between editorial magazine making and commercial pressures and problems today in the industry. It sounds to me like one of the special things about Rob Report is you are not subject to some of the pressures that a British magazine is at the moment.
I think every magazine, if they're solely a magazine, is subject to those pressures because they're real. You know, that's the print advertising has migrated and is migrating online, and it's difficult just to be a magazine these days. Having said that, there are lots of magazines that are launching, but they're little niche, sometimes brilliant magazines about a very particular thing, and whether it's a style mag, and there's a couple that have launched recently, or a thing on podcasting or whatever it is. You get some great little magazines, great paper stock, good ideas, beautiful design, lots of white space and air around things. And I think they're run on a very, very tight budget, and they get two or three media partners or sponsors or advertisers, and they can survive that. How you scale that is, I think, very, very difficult. But maybe they're done as a side hustle, and maybe it's not they're not trying to turn into a big media corporation. For bigger brands, I think it comes back to the brand thing again. You've got to have outlets where you can work with partners. So maybe that's sponsoring an event. And we have brands that come to different parts of Car of the Year, and they're able to meet that audience because for them, so for example, Mr. Porter came to Car of the Year last year, from what they said to me, they were very intrigued and interested about how we managed to create that audience and how they could talk to that audience. So yes, we want the partnerships, but we've also got something that a lot of brands want, which is an audience. So I think there's a symbiosis there, which makes it a bit easier, perhaps.
What about, because the missing piece of the puzzle for me that still troubles me, even though I'm now sort of self-employed and looking into, a lot of the British lifestyle magazines from a slightly detached position for the first time, is none of us can seem to successfully monetize digital. That seems to be the continual pain point. It doesn't matter whether it's a brand that's been around for 100 years or it's a brand that's 2 years old. Do you have any thoughts on what media brands need to be doing today to make digital more of a success than it is?
It's funny, I was sat in a room a few months ago with a few of my colleagues in America, and was talking to one in particular, and we were trying to work out this question. And we just, at one point, just sat back and kind of laughed, because in countries around the globe, there are people having the same conversation in little rooms as we were having right then. And you can almost feel, you kind of, this is where you want to, if I could talk to that bloke in Taiwan, and then they could talk to the guy in China, and then maybe we could all put our heads together and come up with an idea. I've worked on places that have had a paywall, for example, like Sunday Times. So I've been around when they were launching that, and my wife was part of the marketing team that launched that, so she has a view on this too. But, do you put Rob Report online behind a paywall? Do you take some of it and make it for subscribers only? Do you, there's lots of things you can do. It's very hard to know what will work, to be honest. And the short answer is, if I do have an idea, I'm not going to tell you right now.
Fair enough.
But we're working on a couple of things, but it's really hard. And I think the best we've all got is to produce content that is compelling and has to be read, because that draws people to the brand and to the outlet. So you will get people that are interested in coming to you. So your audience will build, and then that audience is valuable.
My theory, and this is the theory of a 26-year-old upstart, so please do just shoot this down if you think it's nonsense, is, this is completely spitballing, if I had to launch a magazine tomorrow or be a part of a team that launched it, I would try, from a budget perspective, to flip the model. Because the problem that I have with a lot of British lifestyle websites is we all write about the same thing. We all use supplied assets, and there's actually, when you boil it down, there's very little that's original. The Mr. Porter website works for me because they have the budget to produce great shoots, to produce really, really top quality long form. I would like to try to find a way or to see a media brand that could launch with enough, you know, sort of, I guess, seed capital to have a print product that's relevant and that builds that niche community and that finds its tribe, but that can plow the money into original online content. That's the piece of the puzzle that always gets missed for me, but I just don't know how you do that from a financial perspective.
You do it with an enormous suitcase full of gold bullion, because it that costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because the internet is a voracious beast, so you can almost never produce too much content. So the danger is you're just throwing money into a hole. You know, you're opening a window and just throwing money out there and hoping it hits the right person.
It lands, yeah.
I mean, you're right. I think Mr. Porter, I think, does it brilliantly. But they have a product that they are selling. And although a lot of their content is fantastic, it always comes back to buy this pair of trousers because it's summer and these are the summer trousers. You know, I've been a huge admirer and reader of Mr. Porter from day one. And half of my wardrobe is from there, but what they do is very clever, but it's not necessarily going to work for other brands. We're the e-commerce part of it is really interesting to me, and that's something that we're exploring at the moment. But for me, it's got to be, you know, Rob Report worthy, if you like. It's a cringe-worthy kind of phrase, but that means it can't just be a really nice pair of shoes that you can buy on other magazine sites or whatever else. We've got to produce ourselves limited edition, really collectible, really desirable products. And we're, you know, talking to people about that. And hopefully, if I come back on Series 7 of your esteemed podcast, I can talk about how successful it's been. But until then, we'll see what happens. But that's something we're hoping to launch in the next quarter, you know, one or two.
Very cool. All right, I'm gonna wait with anticipation then. A few Indeed. More questions. Let's do some more menswear questions.
Sure.
What's it like being a stylish Englishman making a magazine for wealthy Americans?
From a style perspective, let's put it this way. I've been quite surprised that men in Manhattan aren't more interested in how they look. Let's put it that way. Within the limitations and the boundaries of you know, the superficiality that we all exist within, if you care too much about your clothes, then obviously, you know, there are other things to think about. But that said, certainly in Midtown, where my office is, there's very much a uniform. In fact, there's a Instagram account which I think is Midtown Uniform, purely to celebrate the kind of guys who perhaps work in finance and banking that wear a gilet, a blue shirt, and a pair of chinos, and hunt in packs. You know, you see them roving the streets. New York's a funny place. It's like London is full of little places and little tribes and little pockets of things. So if I have to go down and see someone in Soho, it instantly is very different from Midtown. And I wear to work, I've not often wear a suit, but I wear a sports coat and a pair of, you know, in the winter, a pair of flannels or linen trousers in the summer or whatever, and try and work like, you know, that's kind of how I dress. Don't often wear ties. And even like that, if you go down to Soho, you feel wildly overdressed. But in terms of what it's like, I think Americans, for some reason, they respect the British accent, even in print. So they are prepared to listen to styling notes, as we call our style pages. But one of the things I don't think men's magazines in general are helpful enough or useful enough. There's lots of kind of advertiser-driven, here's some crazy fashion, shot in the dark, and it's all black clothes, and it's only sort of lit by neon, and you just think, how's that helpful?
Yeah.
I remember some of these magazines went through a phase of doing the fashion shoots in cartoons. And so you'd have this kind of watercolour picture of a man wearing a blazer, and it would be
in
like
Gucci's
blazers,
current collection.
Gucci, yeah, and you're like, how does that help me? You know, I want to see what it's like. It's utter nonsense. And that, for me, is just kind of editors getting right up their own arse and just not completely forgetting what the point of the magazine is, which is to talk to a reader. And so we do much more kind of, we call them lay downs, where you put outfits together and you kind of say this jumper will work with this jacket. And because that's come about because I used to I've been going to New York for 20 years and love it. And I remember going to J. Crew back in 2007 when they launched the liquor store, which was one of the first kind of men's stores that was predominantly J. Crew, but also sold barber jackets and it sold Ray-Bans and it had various other things. And was one of the first kind of lifestyle stores, really, that I'd certainly discovered anyway. And whoever dressed their mannequins was doing a brilliant job, because I'd walk into that little dingy store and the mannequin in front of me would have, I don't know, let's say summer and it's a seersucker jacket, but it would have a navy t-shirt underneath and a pair of jeans and a pair of white derby shoes and a pocket square or whatever it was. And you'd look at that and you say, okay, I've got jeans like that. I've got a jumper like that. I've even got a pocket square like that. If I buy that jacket, I can look like that. And that, Instagram wasn't around then. That was brilliant to me. And that was a real kind of eye-opening moment for me. That they had just found a kind of merchandising person who was brilliant at it. But that kind of spoke to, I think, well, certainly spoke to me, but it felt like it spoke to their audience. So you translate that kind of 12 years later and with a slightly more luxury kind of outlook to it. I think generally men who have always worn suits to work are quite threatened by this new, slightly more relaxed wave of styling that's happening at the moment. Certainly the kind of Silicon Valley area, shoes kind of tiles and whatever for a much more kind of Brunello Cucinelli style look. I think in New York, people are slightly threatened by that. If you've been in banking or publishing or whatever for a long time, you wear suits, you kind of know where you are with that because you know this goes with that shirt and it goes with that tie and you've got your armour on and off you go. And in fact, one guy I spoke to said that he's been wearing that for 20 years and knows, you know, he's got impeccable suits and whatever. At the weekend, he buys what he said was a terrible old pair of Gap jeans and a kind of baggy sort of branded polo shirt from somewhere. And he can't work the transition between the two. He can do his gardening in the terrible jeans. His words, not mine. But, you know, if you want to be stylish and, well, not even stylish, if you just want to feel that you've made a bit of an effort and go out on a Saturday night to a nice restaurant, it's not always easy to put that kind of outfit together. So I think that's something that Rob Report can really help with. And that's what we try and do each issue and online. And, you know, we're going to get better at it because it's something I think is quite important. And it's part of, if you can be useful to somebody, they will stick with you. If you are the brand that is telling people how to collect watches or how to lay down a cellar or how to dress in a kind of smart casual, cringe kill way, you know, that will get an audience.
Cool.
I hope.
I'm now feeling quite nervous because what you probably don't know is that I filed some copy for you to your deputy editor a few days ago, and I talked about gilets and smart casual. So we'll pick up on that.
Let's not worry about that too much.
Hot brands for you right now. Are there any men's style brands out there that you're really engaging with and enjoying?
There is. So I can never pronounce them. Salmon Abel, is that how
I think it's Sam. Yes, yeah, Salmon Abel.
Right.
We'll find out because they're going to be on this series.
Well, excellent. So I really like what Dag and his partner do there. I think their Instagram is brilliant. They're focused on texture. They make things, as a guy looking into their world, you kind of want to be a part of that world. And they're not doing it by really kind of crazy styling or kind of uber cool stuff, or it's just showing textures and patterns next to each other a lot of the time, and a color palette. And this is the other thing that's been interesting for me recently, is the color palette and tonal dressing or whatever he says in grays and greens and browns
and olives and perfect bang on, bang
and that
on
kind of stuff. But I think that kind of stuff is really smart, and I think what they're doing, they just launched a Mr. Porter. I think that's a great move for them. And I'm excited, they're just having trunk shows in New York, so I'm going to see them in September. So I think they are a very interesting, very modern brand, and how they're talking to their audience is really smart and engaging. I think it's fascinating, all these clothing brands now produce content, and so you're either drawn in by the product or the story. I think Drake still does a really good job. I think Mark is a very quiet and gentle genius, and he and his team do brilliant. You know, they find brilliant cloth and they make great stuff, and the Armory as well, I think, is fantastic. Shop in New York, and I've not been to the one in Hong Kong, but I'm sure it's brilliant. Other brands. I've been having some trousers made by Edward Sexton, but he's not really a new man.
No,
new
no.
brand, particularly just celebrating his 50th anniversary. But I like very much what Dominic's doing there. There must be others, but I can't think of too many at the moment. Stoffer, I think, are really interesting.
Stoffer's very cool.
They've gone completely out of my head. The suede jackets and...
Oh, what, Valstar?
Valstar have been around for a long time, and I think, but they're the kind of the colours they're producing now, and the, you know, they're branching out a little bit more.
The trucker jackets. I've got a tobacco suede trucker jacket from Valstar, and it's the best trucker jacket I've ever had.
Yeah.
They're known for the A1,
yeah.
But the truckers are wicked, and the colours are beautiful.
Yeah. I think Grenfell have been around a long time again. But, you know, Ring Jacket, I went and saw the Ring Jacket collection for autumn winter, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Some of their fabrication and choices are stunning. And they said something really, really interesting to me. And I told, I can't remember who I told, a tailor this, and they said, oh, I'm going to steal that. But Ring Jacket make their silhouette for men with their shoulders slightly forward, because that is how men tend to stand. Whenever you go and see a tailor, you thrust your shoulders back chest comes up and you're kind of militarily straight. But that's not how you live. And they say they cut their jackets with a slightly more rounded shoulder, expecting the shoulder to move forward an inch or two. And I'd never heard of a tailor say that.
No.
I thought that was absolutely fascinating.
That's bloody clever.
And really clever, yeah, exactly. And it's kind of like, wow, okay, someone's really thought about that. But, you know, they're an interesting brand.
Marvellous. Last question then, which I always ask. You've alluded to this, and you may not be able to give me an answer. Big plans for Rob Report. What's coming next? Is there anything exciting on the horizon you want to flag?
There are a couple of things, neither of which I can flag particularly, but there's an event that we're working toward, which I'm very excited about, which is something that it means something to me and has been part of my career. So I'm excited to be able to try and launch an idea in that kind of world. I'm really excited by the e-commerce stuff. The stuff that we've got hopefully to launch this year is really cool, and is where I think we should be going. But in general, I think we've got to do what we do and keep doing it better. You know, we keep talking to guys who are really successful, so they don't sort of take shit from people, and they're smart. And they do their own research, and if you say something's good, they will then not blindly go out and buy it, but they will check it out, and they will they will respond to that. So whether that's in newsletters or whether that's on Instagram or in print or as bigger events, it's just trying to communicate better to people. And we're all on the other side of it. We all have brands trying to talk to us, whether it's a magazine that we like, or it's a radio program or whatever it is, or it's a clothing brand. You know, you choose which ones you allow to bombard you with messages, and you stand back and get pummeled by it. And the brands that do well are the ones that kind of step back a bit and go, okay, so what exactly does this guy want? So we'll keep trying to do that.
Brilliant. Well, Paul, thank you so much indeed for taking some time out, because I know you're super slammed. I find listening to you incredibly interesting and inspiring and refreshing.
That's very kind of you to say.
I can't wait to see what's coming for the rest of this year for Rob Report. So thank you very much
indeed. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, there we are, folks. That's your fill of menswear-related wisdom for the week. Unfortunately, this is the only other episode in Series 2 that we recorded before we started to end on quickfire questions. So that's all we've got for you this week. We'll be back next Wednesday with quickfire questions, and between now and then, follow us on Instagram at Handcut Radio and message us on there with any thoughts or feedback you might have. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the podcast. This is a new project for all of us at Handcut Radio, as you know, and every shout out and every review we receive really does help to spread word. The podcast is produced by Birch, a London and New York-based creative agency. Check out their work at thinkbirch.com. Our theme music is by Joe Boyd. You can hear more from him by tuning in at This Is Joe Boyd. Thank you also to Blacks Club for giving us a space to record this episode. And finally, a huge thank you to you for listening, and we'll see you in a few days' time.